Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio.
We move like ghosts through the ether, silent and undetectable, gathering information that can't be gathered any other way. To Al-Qaeda, we are of the Jinn. To the FBI, we are psychic spies. Being a remote viewer can also result in an exorbitant amount of high strangeness. It opens the door to mind-bending projects, which force you to see the world in a completely different light. One moment you're working on predicting markets for a hedge fund. The next, you're an inverted contact point to an alien species asking for your help. I didn't arrive at remote viewing with the belief I had any psychic ability at all. It was, in fact, the words of Mr. Causey ultimately driving me. As a child, he warned me to always remember the time before words, the moment before thought is created. This obsession sent me on a journey to explore my consciousness and to know the self, where it left me to live in a Zen center while running a team of remote viewers. Get John's book, The Time Before Secret Words, on the path of remote viewing, high strangeness, and Zen, on Amazon. And now, here's K-Town with special guest, John Vivanco.
When I first became aware of it, it was like I turned into a 10-year-old boy. It was 1995, and I remember the moment. I was watching television, and it was, if you know, people remember Ted Koppel. You know, this guy was like the uncle of America as far as media goes. And I was watching it, a TV show called Nightline. And he started to talk about this program that had just become declassified called remote viewing, and he referenced psychic spies. Now, I didn't really hear anything else after that. To me, it became a validity on something that I knew already existed. And my brain just went crazy. I literally just kept repeating remote viewing, psychic spies, remote viewing, psychic spies. It was like, you know, I was like a little kid wanting to wear a cape when I heard that. And so he presented it in a way that it didn't really work, because the air report that the CIA put out that he was really basing his segment on in that TV show was that remote viewing didn't have really any applicable uses, right? So it didn't matter to me, because I didn't hear that part. Because anybody who has ever had a psychic type experience in the past will know that that is a real thing, right? And here you have a government agency over 20 years or so develop the tools, in a sense, well, research and develop the tools and turn it into an actual intelligence gathering program. So that's the moment that I really got involved with remote viewing, was 1995. And for me, after that, it was, you think about the internet back then. That's how you get information these days. There was not a huge internet, right? And so I had to dig around. Like, you know, there were little forums here and there. So I had to dig around on what this was and how to do it. Because, you know, to receive formal training, that would cost you around $12,000 back then. And on top of that, you know, you have ex-military intelligence officers that are training it. Now, the thing with intelligence is that you never really become ex-military when you're, you know, an intelligence officer. You're running programs for the rest of your life if need be, right? So I didn't necessarily want to get trained by those people either, yet, you know, those were the only people in the field. So I had to cobble together, you know, bits and pieces on how to do it at first, until I got formally trained by somebody who was outside of the military, you know.
So, okay, you went outside the military. That's something because, you know, I mean, my first time hearing about remote viewing is when, you know, I started this show and I had no idea. I mean, I knew psychics were real. To me, they were. I've had a reading before, but I did not know the government was so invested in these programs. But they were not the only ones doing it. I've heard about right. China doing it and Russia. I mean, were all of them doing it at the same time? Well, do you know any history about that?
Yeah, so the way it started out was early 1970s. Okay, so the CIA gets word that the Soviets are trying to develop psychics as spies. And now the thing with the Soviets is that they were a little bit more interested in this like psychotronic aspect, where they can influence diplomats and people in power using psychics. They were very much into that aspect. But the CIA heard about this. So, you know, they're like, we've got to investigate this ourselves, because if they're a step ahead in intelligence gathering, then we're screwed. So even if it sounds stupid to most people, we've got to go after this and figure out if it works, bottom line, right? So they enlisted Hal Targ and Russell Pudoff, who were physicists. It was really Hal Pudoff at first who they brought in, and then he brought in Russell Targ. So they brought these guys in. They started to create different ideas on how to go about testing psychic people to see if you can get consistent, repeatable, solid information on things. The big problem back then was that nobody in the parapsychology research fields believed that psychic information can be utilized in a consistent manner, because it's always hit or miss. You know, when you go to a psychic, remote viewing is different than psychic, and we'll get to that. But when you go to a psychic, their information can be way off in left field, and then the next moment it could be dead on, right? So it can go back and forth between being, you know, solid and not solid. Now, that was their main thing that they had to figure out. How do you create consistency in what the psychics are giving you on the side of it being solid information? Because that's what you need for intelligence gathering. So they went through a number of different experiments, research side, and very strict controls. Now, one of the big problems with getting psychic information is that you are basically telling the psychic what you want to know. Like, hey, when's my next girlfriend coming along? When am I going to get this great job? When am I going to make all this money? Now, the psychic knows what it is that you are you're wanting to know. So that's what they had to avoid, right? That was their big issue. How do you ask a psychic a question and get an answer to it without asking them the question? So Ingo Swann, he was one of their main test subjects, and he was such an A personality that he really took over large portions of it, right? Now, he was an artist out of New York City, and he, you know, was brought into the program. You know, he's a starving artist. He's brought into this program in Menlo Park in San Francisco, working on psychic research for the CIA at Stanford Research Institute, and it was about, they gave him about 3 months to come up with something to tell them whether this is feasible or not feasible. And Ingo, you know, he was up against the wall here because he was going to go back to New York. You know, he's getting a lot of money on this. And he's going to go back to New York and be a starving artist again. So he had to come up with something when he got right down to it. So he grabbed a bottle of scotch. He went back to his apartment pool. He sat in that pool most of the night, just drinking the bottle of scotch with one problem on his mind. And how do you send a remote viewer to or a psychic to something without giving them the question? So he was sitting there, bobbing in the pool, totally wasted, and he heard in his head coordinates.
Okay, so but he was the one that they put this problem or asked to solve this problem, correct?
No, now see, it was Hal Pudoff and Russell Targ, the scientists running the program, who were really in control of everything. Now, he was a test subject, but he got so involved in it, and he got such an A personality that he just went after it. He wanted to figure it out, right? He wanted to figure it out from inside. How do you do this? These guys, you know, they were more interested in, you know, describe what I put in this box right here, or describe the Zener card that I put on the shelf the next room. These really boring experiments and proving that psychic information can be consistent in that way. And then later on, trying to apply that to intelligence gathering methods. It's a really boring way to go after psychic testing. Really boring. Psychics get bored with that. And they were still up against an issue where they didn't have a consistency in what the psychics were giving them. For one thing, they worked on something called the outbounders, where they would send a person out in the field to an undisclosed location to the psychics, like to a park or to a zoo or something. And the psychics would sit there and start sketching and drawing as if they were looking through this person's eyes, where subject was, where this person was. And, you know, it was accurate, off and on accuracy. But that doesn't work for intelligence gathering purposes, even though it was impressive to people. If you're going to send somebody to a location and then have psychics look through their eyes, you know, I mean, why send psychics when you know what that location is all about to begin with, right? So even though it was impressive to a degree, they were proving their point that this stuff does work, they can get some consistency out of it, they still needed like an address system. They needed some kind of address system to give a remote viewer, to give a psychic. So the psychic didn't know what was behind that address. You know, if I gave you an address to my home, would you be able to tell me where I lived? Would you be able to describe my house? No, most people wouldn't. So when Ingo Swann was bobbing in that pool and he heard coordinates, that was the idea of the address system to give psychics. Now you think about coordinates on the earth. I mean, endless, really. So you can give a person a coordinate somewhere on this planet, maybe a suspected secret submarine base, right? Classified information. And they can write that number down and they can just start describing, right? So that is where everything turned around with the program of remote viewing that the CIA was interested in. When they took that methodology, that protocol to the CIA and demonstrated it, the CIA was so impressed that they even had to classify, because the CIA supplied the coordinates for the test, they had to classify the information that the remote viewers came up with. So there's where it really took off. The moment that Ingo came up with a coordinate style system of remote viewing. Now, these days, we don't use Earth coordinates. What we do is we, you know, at a certain point, think about this, like coordinates are a conceptual framework for locations on a surface, right? So it's a conceptual framework. So you can create your own conceptual framework. So I can make up a random 4-digit or 8-digit number. And then I could just write down what I want you to remote view and just give you that number, right? So that's how we do it these days. And that opens it up to different types of non-local information than just locations on a planetary surface. In other words, you can go back in time. You can go into the future. You can go to the other side of the universe. You can view things in other dimensions, multidimensional space. So it really opened it up to a much broader aspect of things that you wanted to know about.
That is just mind-boggling, really. Ingo Swann's very fascinating to me, and I'm starting to collect all of his books. It's just amazing. I want to ask you something about, I'm really interested in what you said about the Russians. The Russians, when the United States caught wind of them potentially using psychics to, I guess, influence world leaders. Are you talking about in a way where they were controlling their mind or exploring their consciousness? Do you know anything?
Oh, yeah. You know, really, it's all about how to influence somebody else to do what you want them to do. So, yes, it would be a type of,
gotcha,
of mind control. Mind control. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, they were also interested in devices, you know, sort of non-lethal weapons that can subdue minds, in a sense. They were very interested in the application of telekinesis type or not telekinesis, but psychokinesis.
Like moving things with your mind or something?
Yes, they were very interested in moving things with the mind and how that influenced people.
Okay, so did Ingo ever do that?
No, so none of that stuff was in the program. None of the psychokinesis stuff was at least on the surface level of the program. Now, here's the thing. When you get into these types of government programs, you have other government agencies that will, once they become a little bit more spread out, open leaks, you have other government agencies that are tapping into them and pulling off information on stuff that they've learned about. And one of the issues with the SRI program is that SRI was more of a public type institution. And so a lot of the stuff started leaking out. And so you had people in black projects that were interested. Now, the normal surface layer of government intelligence wasn't so interested in it because, you know, not believing in it, basically. But under the surface, you had different types of black projects try and integrate what they were learning into what they were doing. So it's conceivable that there are agencies that have figured out psychokinesis. I know for myself. You know, when I got pulled into the wild and woolly world of remote viewing, I got sucked into a think tank and started working with handlers in intelligence agencies. I started working with businesses. I started working with government people. And what I found through my handlers is that remote viewing and more esoteric types of practices are very much used within intelligence gathering circles.
Tell us what other types of esoteric practices.
Well, I mean, they'll use a type of astral projection in places, in locations, as with sort of this, like, you know, kind of a term called extension neurosensing, where you can subject an individual to, let's just say, 750 nanometer wavelength light, which is in the IR spectrum, along with like a PEMF pulsing in the 7 hertz range, as well as sound, which will vibrate them. It's sort of like a sarcophagus type situation, which will vibrate them, their body and their consciousness, to a point where they can astral project much stronger than they could without this stuff. So this began a mixing of technology with esoteric practices to push the envelope, so to speak. So now with the astral projection type side, now remote viewing is not astral projection. This is something different. This is a different type of esoteric practice. But astral projection is something that some of these projects were looking at and going into, as well as telepathy, in order to get more concise, better information on things. I mean, When you astral project, like if you're doing a remote viewing session, every once in a while we have an experience called bilocation. It's somewhat akin to astral projection. This is something that's absolutely a fascinating field, and I know it's fascinating when you get into these projects where they have a lot of money behind it and trying to figure this stuff out, because there have been reports where during astral projection, the people can be seen. So they're trying to push things to a higher new level of interaction, because one of the biggest things that these agencies have gone after under the surface have been contact with beings in multidimensional space or aliens, and trying to move it to a place where people can be projected to them, where they can be better interacted with. So that's really the way it goes, to gain better intelligence information and things like that. So that's a huge area, that and telepathy. Those two different practices are a huge area that they worked on.
Wow. Yeah. Bilocation is so fascinating. You know, I heard about a guy, and I can't remember, he was in the religious order somewhere, where he was known to bilocate, they said. You know, he was sitting exactly. somewhere. Yeah, he was sitting somewhere like for hours and didn't move. And they news came back that he was seen on the other side of the world helping some other people. And then he came back, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a really fascinating story that you're bringing up there. I mean, that I recall that story. I don't recall who it was, but I recall that story. Now, one thing that happened to me early on when I began to learn remote viewing was that I was tasked on something. We were in training, a bunch of us, because we were developing a think tank. And we, you know, you'll put a monitor with a remote viewer sometimes in order to get more concise, better information, right? So we were a group of people in a room. I had a monitor and the other remote viewers had monitors. And we were all tasked on the same thing. You know, it's practice stuff. We don't know what we're tasked on to remote view. But so I'm remote viewing. I'm the remote viewer. I've got a monitor. And during the whole session, I'm bouncing back and forth between this house on fire and a person or a subject in the house who's running around trying to figure out what to do. And then I would bounce to this other scene of a subject who is in a metal tube with maps and scopes doing various things in this metal tube. I kept going back and forth between the two for about an hour, just describing these two different scenes. And my monitor was getting frustrated with me. So my monitor said, all right, you know, I want you to stand up and I want you to go to the door of the house you're in, and I want you to open the door and step outside. So I stood up, I did what he said, and I closed my eyes and I pretend walked. I went to the door. So the moment that I opened this door, I had this bilocation experience where I was completely in different location, in a different realm. I started running and looking around because this whole city was on fire. It was just in flames, and I started to get burned. I was feeling a burning sensation all around me, and I knew where I was. I knew that I was in Dresden, and I started running in place and yelling, I'm in Dresden, I'm on fire. And all the viewers stopped and looked at me, and I had burns on me. For about 15 minutes, I had burns on me. So this right here is an example. Now, I'm sure back in Dresden during the firebombing of World War II, and that's what I was tasked on, given the feedback right after that, I'm sure somebody in Dresden had to see this shape running down the road screaming, which was me, because you can tell when you're in a scene in remote viewing, when you have a bilocation experience, that it is an aspect of astral projection, but even more so, you are literally launching yourself into another place where I am sure that that aspect of yourself can be seen, because I came back with burn marks on me that lasted 15 minutes. Now, you take that and you apply it, and these remote viewers are having these experiences in the military program, and then you apply that to, you know, research. You go, how do we recreate this situation? How do we push it so that we can get testing done? We can do research on actually, in controlled circumstances, getting people to bilocate and see them somewhere else, right? So they went through these sessions, these programs, trying to do that kind of stuff, not on the top level of the remote viewing program we know today, but in other projects, they've done that.
You know what? I mean, have you? Wow. You know, that is very fascinating. I'm sure someone saw you in that time and at that place. Someone saw something strange that they couldn't explain, you know, because you had burn marks. I mean, the evidence was the burn marks.
The
on
evidence
your skin.
Was the burn marks.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, now here's another thing, too. You know, if you've read Ingo Swann's Penetration, the book Penetration, fantastic book. So really, he goes into the moon and talks about the moon. And when he first started to, he was asked by this other intelligence agency to remote view some structures on the moon. And when he remote viewed them, there was one moment where his monitor was saying, did they notice you? Did they see you? Do you know if they saw you? Because Inga was getting all this stuff. He was getting structures. He was getting beings, right, that he couldn't identify. So the monitor was like, if they saw you get out right now, right now. So the monitor basically shut the session down. And Inga was like, what's going on here? You know, he started freaking out. It's like, what the heck's going on the moon? There's stuff on the moon. There's aliens up there. I mean, I think that was his first real big launch into it, right? There's aliens? This doesn't make any sense to my world. So after that period of time, Ingo had found out that when you remote view these locations, whether you're bilocating or not, these other beings are going to notice you there. So it has to do with awareness, right? It has to do with expanded awareness. So when me and my team remote view the moon, we have to be careful, right? This has happened many, many times. When you remote view things that are not of this earth, these beings have a broader awareness and they will take notice of you, as has happened through multiple projects that I've ever done. I mean, multiple projects, whether that's for ourselves or somebody in a weird black project that's asking us to do things. I mean, you have to be really careful as a remote viewer on that front, because you don't know what you're going to come across. You know, it's kind of like a you're dealing with remote viewing is kind of like a mental martial art in a sense. And you are to learn and be a remote viewer is like learning how to operate in a fourth dimensional alley, right? A fourth dimensional dark alley at times. And so you have to know how to deal with that kind of stuff, right?
Okay, so can we say there about your experience? You said you have actually remote viewed the moon. So first of all, you said that Ingo was there and that I guess he was experiencing. Okay, you said that they were asking him if they could see him. Do you think that they had some idea at that time that if he was there and he was exploring the moon mentally, that these beings were evolved enough to where they already had the ability to also see him, even though his body wasn't there physically? Is that right. What you're saying? They already knew something like that was possible, or were they just asking him, hey, can they see you too?
So one thing you have to understand is that when you get really sensitive on the psychic side, if you meditate a lot, it clears your thinking mind out. Most people don't notice when there's strange energies in a room with them, ghostly type energies, because they have too many thoughts. But the remote viewer is trained in more of a meditative state. And when you don't have thoughts that are just a bunch of noise, you can pick up on other energies that are around you. Now, when you get to species, many species who are what we would consider aliens, a lot of those species have a very developed mind from the aspect of telepathy, and just being very sensitive to different types of energies and noticing things that are approaching them that are not just in the 3D reality. We find this over and over again. So for me, for instance, I can sense when there's another remote viewer viewing me, because there's a sensation. I've been doing this for so long, I know what it feels like. So there's a sensation inside of me, in my body. So when the monitor was asking Ingo if they noticed him, that's what he was referring to. Did they notice him psychically? Because, you know, I actually had tasked remote viewers on this. When I say we, it's like me and my team. We have actually looked at the reason why his monitor shut the session down, right? What did he know? What was he afraid of? And what he was afraid of was being attacked again. So what apparently had happened was he had sent other remote viewers to the moon, to these some of these structures in this black project that was funded by the U.S. government, to understand what these structures were and who built them and who was there. So in these earlier instances, what happened was the viewers went there. They were noticed by the aliens. The aliens, they can track back psychically, mentally, to the people, person who did it, and where they are, and attack them. This is something like when you get into the like the underground remote viewing lore and what people talk about under the surface, this kind of stuff happens even to regular remote viewers. Not necessarily attacked, but you will get visited more often than not by beings who are basically on the moon or remote viewing other alien species if they can make it here. I mean, I've had physical encounters with beings as well as other remote viewers, literally physical encounters. More often than not, though, it will be sort of a psychic. They'll come at you psychically like later on or the next day, right?
Tell me a physical encounter. Tell me, that's really interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, okay, so we were working on a project. We were doing this project for Ruben Uriarte and Joyce Murphy, and this was a learning channel for the network, the Learning Channel, and they were going to Puerto Rico. They had a TV show, Beyond Boundaries, I think, and they did expeditions to look for paranormal phenomena and have experiences. So they came to us and they asked us if we would remote view the Chupacabra, because that's what they wanted to go after. And they also said that they had some stories that were coming out of the local area around Arecibo Telescope, the one featured in the movie Contact, that there were a lot of lights in the sky and coming down into the jungle and stuff. And they wanted us to look at that as well. So they were going to put that stuff as part of their television show and use it to go on an expedition. So we started viewing this stuff, and I was one of the viewers on it. And I was tasked at one point on what the lights in the sky were. And, I'm blind. We're always blind when we remote view. It's a very strict methodology and protocol. And so I just started sensing these beings that were coming from the sky, from space, and they were what we would call paraphysical and physical. So they had these aspects that were like fourth and fifth dimensional as well as third dimensional, but they existed more in the fourth-ish kind of dimension than straight up third dimension. They could transit in and out, so like you could see them and couldn't see them. So they were coming down to Earth. They were coming to the jungle. They were they were on a mission in a sense. And they would land in the jungle and sort of pop out of these small craft. And they, to me, when I was viewing them, they had a very acerbic intelligence and they were very, very focused. And when I was viewing them, I was getting the distinct impression, you start to get a feeling like they were aware of me remote viewing them, and they may show up later on. There could be a chance they'll show up later on. So I was a little bit, freaked out about that aspect because they had such a very, very tight, strong focus. So it was probably, I don't know, I don't remember how long it was after. It had to have been a couple weeks or so. I was at home and this strange light started happening in the house, and I fell asleep. I got just inordinately tired. It was very bizarre. I fell asleep just like that, and I was launched into an immediate dream. And in this dream, I was stuck in space. It had to do with these beings. And I was having this experience in the dream where these beings were coming towards me. And while I was dreaming this, I started to get tapped on the shoulder, like, wake up, wake up, wake up. So, I grab, like, while I'm half asleep, grab the hand that's tapping me. And there was this strange sensation of kind of a slick, it was slightly slick and cool and bumpy that was on me. And so I let go of it really fast, and I open my eyes, and I look, and right in front of me is this being. It's about 3 feet tall, and it's got this head that looks like a football on its side, not like your gray-type alien beings. And it's got these two little black dots for eyes on the ends of the football. And they look like, like hammerhead shark eyes kind of thing. And it had like this long, spindly limbs. Like if you've ever seen the movie Galaxy Quest, this is probably like an early 2000s B movie. Looked a little bit like the spindly limbs like that, like just crowded octopus limbs. And this thing's just like standing there, like literally just a couple feet in front of me. And I'm freaking out. Like, I'm like, what is this thing? And so I'm backing up on the bed, like pushing myself against the wall, like, whoa, I'm gonna like jump on this thing. I don't know what it is. And immediately it projects into my mind that it's not here to hurt me. And what I'm doing with my emotions right in this moment is actually hurting it. Like it was giving me the visuals of me throwing bricks at it with my emotions. And it was hurting it, actually hurting it. So I'm like, what the heck? So I pulled back on that, and then it gave me the telepathic understanding that it's here to help me, to help us, the remote viewing team, and it would like my help as well. It was the strangest thing. Like, I didn't understand what was happening. Then after that, it literally just sort of exploded into these sparks and disappeared. And I'm just, you know, hyperventilating, going, what the heck just happened? I'm awake. I'm totally awake. I'm not hallucinating. I don't do drugs. I'm like, this is crazy. So after that, another person on the team had a similar experience. I didn't tell my team because, you know, I'm like, well, I didn't know what to do with this. I figured, you know, at some point that we would remote view what happened, but then it happened to another person on the team. Described the same beings. So these beings were from that particular project. And what happened was I stepped in the way. They were not coming here to Earth for human beings. They were coming here for a different species altogether. You know, humans can be very egotistical. Oh, aliens are just here for us. No, that's not true. There's so many things on this planet. This is an incredible planet. So many different beings. These beings came, they weren't interested in dealing with humans. They were coming for something else here. But I stepped in the way and they became interested and then wondered how I could help them.
That's unbelievable. That is wild. Yeah, I mean, what does it feel like when you remote view? Are you aware of your body?
Yeah, when you remote view, it's okay, remote viewing, the term is erroneous. So what happens when you remote view? So what does a remote viewer do? It's not like their eyes roll in the back of their head and they start convulsing. You know, it's a very boring thing to watch. What happens is that they've got a piece of paper in front of them and they are closing their eyes, they're going inside of themselves, they're using their five senses, their sound, smell, touch, taste, textures. They're using their internal five senses to describe things at a very low level. Sometimes they'll get visuals. So from the viewing aspect in the term remote viewing, it's inaccurate because remote viewing is all the senses from sound, smells, touch, taste to literally a knowingness, just a knowingness about what's there. And then the occasional visuals. It isn't like you're watching a movie in your mind. And then now the remote part. So what does a person do when they're remote viewing? Well, they close their eyes. They go inside themselves. They search around for sensations. So there's nothing remote about it, right? And so remote viewing term is erroneous for what it truly is. There's nothing remote about it, and it's not necessarily viewing. Now, remote viewing is literally, like, you could not do it. What do? You go inside yourself. How is it that you can sense something outside of yourself, inside of yourself? Well, it's because you are that thing. You know, it's because remote viewing, they could have called it demonstrations in oneness, right? But, you know, it's not as sexy as remote viewing. It's literally because you are everything that you can do this. That's what remote viewing is at core. It's not actually remote viewing.
Let me ask you something about your remote viewing. You described your team. Is this a team that you put together? I mean, are you the one giving the coordinates? I'm trying to get some sense of what's happening before I ask you these questions.
Yeah. So the way I work it is that I have a team of remote viewers. I train people as well, right? So I train them. I put them through extensive program, and then I work with them. And then I utilize these remote viewers to work on various projects. a lot of the stuff that I work on these days is, you know, more esoteric, strange, paranormal stuff. But yes, so I task them, but I also get tasked myself. So I also remote view too.
Who tasks you? Who reaches out to you for help with their projects? Can you tell us that or not?
I have, well, sometimes I will work with people who are in security, whether that's intelligence or whether that is civilian, people who are ex-military in security work, or people who are in business, to people who more or less want a reading about their life or about an experience that happened to them. I get a lot of people who are abductees who want to know what happened on this strange event in their life, trying to untangle things. So I work across the board, and I'll task my team on all these types of things. And then I will also have my team task me back, or very select people on my team task me back. Now, I don't take straight, like, I don't have outside people task me. You know, this is one of the things in remote viewing. It's like, don't take candy from strangers, because, as I said earlier, most people don't understand that a remote viewer is not this like indifferent anthropologist studying a different culture, right? Sitting on the outside and jotting notes down. A remote viewer becomes part of something. You know, when I got burned, right? You know that different beings can perceive you and attack you. But well, you can have a good time, and then you can have a bad time sometimes, right? So, you know, with the case with these other aliens that I had, that was a good time. You know, that developed into a relationship. Now, with other beings, it can develop into a negative relationship where you can have abduction experiences, right? So you have to be careful with that. And since most people don't know about it, every single thing that somebody wants has to be vetted by an experienced remote viewer before it can be tasked to remote viewers, because you don't know if they know how to properly task or what the heck they're going to task you on, right? And that can be a dangerous area.
Got you. All right. And so when you said what you do is fascinating. When you said you guys tackle more of the esoteric type subjects, I would love to know. I mean, can you discuss some of that with me? Can I ask you about some things that I'm curious about, just to see if you guys have looked at those events? What about Bigfoot?
Oh, okay. So I got to tell you. So a lot of what I do is expedition based now, where we remote view strange locations, paranormal locations, and then I'll use remote viewing data to guide me to evidence, right? So Bigfoot, you know, was never really on my radar. I mean, I knew of Bigfoot. I spent a lot of time in the forest, but, you know, it's like I would go after the stranger cryptids. Now, Bigfoot has really gotten on my radar because of some very strange stuff around Bigfoot that I've witnessed myself, and that we have gotten involved with some strange things in remote viewing projects around Bigfoot. So, for instance, in Mount Shasta, California, we were looking for a cave of giant mummies. That's a legend in that area, right? So we were going through this big project trying to understand, first off, is it real? Because you hear these stories from this guy named J.C. Brown in the early 1900s, a geologist who was tasked to go look for gold in the Cascade Mountain Range, claimed that he had come across a cave full of giant mummies that he believed were the king and queen of Lemuria, basically, you know, this underground city under Mount Shasta, right? So he believed that they were, you know, they were this old race that he had found. Now, at that time in the United States, there were many giants being, you know, discovered and dug up all across the U.S. So this is, you know, not out of the ordinary, to tell you the truth. So we determined that this story was real. So I started to hunt for it, right? I want to find this cave. So I find this one site around Mount Shasta where there are old petroglyphs carved on it, right? And we remote viewed that site it was associated with the cave, with the cave site, this petroglyph site in our remote viewing data. We found out that J.C. Brown, the original person who found the cave, had carved these. We saw this remote viewing data, carved these, and he was using it as his campsite marker place to get back to this cave full of giant mummies, right? So one thing that I always task is, how do we get evidence of what we're looking for? I tasked on, how do we get from the cave, how do we get from the petroglyph site to the cave site? Describe that. So I get all this data back, and I have data like across the board, multiple different remote viewers saying the same thing. There's a large hairy creature. They describe on a low level, right? They don't go to high level concepts. So they just describe a large hairy creature that is arranging things into sticks and patterns in the woods. Like sticks rocks into patterns in the woods. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to me. Why would a bear be doing? I mean, I'm thinking it's a bear, right? So I am up in Mount Shasta. I'm with a friend who I investigate with up there. And I didn't tell him anything about this data because I didn't know what to do with it. And it's quite often you don't know what to do with this data until something presents itself to you. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, my friend says, hey, did you know that Bigfoot makes glyphs in the forest? Like, what do you mean? It's like, yeah, Bigfoot will arrange sticks and stuff into big structures and patterns in the forest. I'm like, no, what are you talking about? Immediately my mind goes to the data. I'm like, that was a Bigfoot, not a bear. I'm interpreting it as a bear. And the data is basically saying you've got to follow. I mean, this is where things get into really bizarre high strangeness side, is that you've got to follow these Bigfoot glyphs in the forest because Bigfoot has some kind of role or protective sense around this site. So I go back into the forest with this knowledge, and I'm like, holy cow. So here you have a tree that's been uprooted, and the root ball, the literal root ball, is stuck in the crook, is put up in the crook of another tree. And then there are other big trees or branches that are busted and like wound through it in impossible ways that deadfall can't account for. So I'm going through the forest and I'm looking at these things, and I'm starting to remote view more and more Bigfoot. In trying to understand this creature, because I've seen the evidence of it, and I've heard this creature in the forest as well. I've never seen it, but it became a really fascinating point for me trying to understand what this being is.
Let me ask you something about the Patterson-Gimlin film. Have you looked at that?
No, we haven't looked at that film yet. We've looked at other films. So we haven't looked at that one. I know there have been other remote viewers that have looked at it and have gotten mixed information on it.
Really? That's interesting. All right. Yeah. So do you plan to do that one, that event at some point?
Yes, I do. I plan to do that. I mean, we've looked at other Bigfoot films online. You find on YouTube, and I'm telling you, I mean, many of them are real, because the viewers, you know, when you get data back on something like that, the viewers will describe somebody in a suit, most likely, or humans having fun, messing around, hoaxing. They'll get that language, or they will get a very powerful creature who feels in themselves very strong, looking for food. And more often than not, that's what we get when we view these videos. More often than not.
Really?
Yeah.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.